ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The beach is Australia's playground. The names are world famous. Manly, Bells, Cottesloe, Kira, Noosa, to name a few. We are blessed with some of the most majestic coastline found on the planet. Culturally, it's where Australians flock for recreation, and it's central to Australia's identity. Tragically, this was shattered on Sunday when an act of terror at Australia's most famous beach, Bondi, hijacked a time of celebration. This week on Australia Wide, we will take a deep dive into the issues facing our coastal communities. Australia has been slow to embrace wind farm technology, particularly offshore. Overseas, especially in Europe, massive wind farms power millions of homes. And it's a common sight to see the lights of the wind turbines off the coast when you take a walk on the beach at night. Here in Australia, though, people are hesitant about the prospect of massive wind turbines out to sea dotting the coastline. In New South Wales, it became a significant issue during the federal election, with locals debating the pros and cons of opening up another industry along their coastline. Take this exchange between two surfers on opposite side of the debate.
Do you think they're going to say, hey mate, we're going to do this and it'll be great? They're going to shaft you to pieces.
What do you mean?
Of those things out there, yeah. And you'll go, oh, gee.
And
that's
I'll say,
different.
Are they going to be behind the ships that I see all along the horizon?
It won't matter.
Because I don't really give a shit if I'm looking at coal ships all day, mate.
A wavering social licence has investors worried, and the money is starting to walk away. This year, big projects off the coast of Tasmania, Victoria and New South Wales have been dumped by international backers. Today in Australia Wide, what is the role of offshore wind in Australia's future energy mix? I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country in Perth. Large parts of Australia enjoy a stiff offshore breeze. In fact, Australia's consistent winds at sea are considered amongst the world's best. Up there with the North Sea between Britain and Europe, one of the world's leading offshore wind regions. This potential for offshore wind has been recognised by the Australian government, with six declared offshore wind areas. The spots considered favourable are off the coast of Gippsland in Victoria, also the Southern Ocean in Victoria, the Hunter and Illawarra region in New South Wales, the Windy Bass Strait in Tasmania, and the Indian Ocean off of Bunbury in Western Australia. Now, despite favourable conditions, Australia's offshore wind industry is very much in its infancy. The first projects are only expected to come online in the early 2030s. Today in Australia Wide, we're taking a look at what's holding up the offshore wind industry in Australia. To do so, I'm joined by two of my colleagues who've been covering this issue, Kelly Fuller in the Illawarra and Danielle Pope in Gippsland. Thanks for joining me.
Hello.
Thank you.
And also we're joined by Ty Christopher, who's the Director of Energy Futures Network at the University of Wollongong. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, first, Ty, let's get the lay of the land, or we're talking about the lay of the sea, I suppose. What makes a spot good for large industrial wind farms?
The thing to remember is that I think this is something that hasn't been well explained in the public discourse thus far, is the why of offshore wind. And it's got three aspects to it fundamentally. One of the things we need to make sure in our renewable or clean energy future is that we have very large capacity generators there to supply, in particular, our industrial centres and our major population centres. It's outright capacity. We need multi-gigawatt scale generators to do the big things that we need in the grid. There's a role for home solar. There's a role for smaller generators in the grid, absolutely. But we do need some large generation capacity in there as well. So size is important in the generation space. The other thing is, of course, availability. And you touched on this with your introduction when you spoke about the wind resource that's there off the coast of Australia. Australia is blessed with probably the best solar resource of any nation and any continent on the globe. But we're also certainly in the top 10, probably the top five when it comes to wind resources as well. And what that means is offshore wind in particular has a high availability. We talk about that as our capacity factor. It's available between 40 and 60% of the time. it's actually a match in terms of availability for coal-fired generation, given how old it is in the East Coast grid of Australia. And so the third aspect of the why of offshore wind is proximity. We love to think of ourselves as all rough, tough bushies here in Australia, but the fact is we're thin-blooded coasties, and we all live around, and all of our industry and our population is right around the edge of Australia, around the coast. And this is where the offshore aspect really comes in to offshore wind, because even placing turbines 20 or 30 kilometres out to sea is still placing the generation of electricity far, far closer to where it needs to be used than doing anything in the centre of Australia and having to build hundreds, if not thousands, of kilometres of new transmission lines to connect that renewable generation to where the electricity is going to be used.
Ty, I'm interested, though, there's six designated areas, and we've established Australia's a windy spot up there in the top 10 windy spots in the world. That's new information for me. But, you know, those six designated areas, why there? What's special about those areas? Is it depth of the ocean? Obviously, it has to be windy, but well, what makes those a good spot to put these wind turbines?
It's a combination of several factors, but the two main ones are the wind resource. As we've said before, the wind's got to be blowing, but also their nearby large industrial connections and large industrial centres here in Australia. I got asked in an interview a while ago, offshore wind turbines are so great, why aren't they putting them out to sea in front of Bondi? And the answer is, well, that's a political question. The bottom line is, this is not a political issue, it's a technical one. Bondi doesn't have a steelworks, the Illawarra does. Mm-hmm. That's why the Illawarra was selected. Similarly for Newcastle, similarly for Gippsland and its proximity to where electricity has been generated historically through fossil fuel means for half a century now. So it's the combination of proximity to where you can use bulk electricity as well as the wind resource to generate it being available.
And Ty, in terms of the wind turbines themselves that we're talking about being offshore, wind turbines have changed greatly since the 80s when we started to see them. I believe modern turbines are about the size of the Eiffel Tower. Is that right? 300 metres tall?
Correct. And that comes down to generating as much capacity as you can from each turbine. In fact, those ones you're talking about there in the energy geekery that is my world are around 15 megawatts in rating for one individual turbine. The latest ones that are coming out of China are actually being developed to be larger than that again in the 20 to 26 megawatt range for an individual turbine. And that's fundamentally so that you have fewer of them out there to sea, and the power that they generate is very significant on a per turbine basis.
So these big turbines, they generate a huge amount of energy because they're bigger and better than they were before. How does that energy get from there to shore and into transmission lines?
There's quite a bit of infrastructure that's needed to gather the energy generated from each individual turbine to usually what's called a floating offshore substation. At that substation, the voltage is transformed, the cables are all marshalled, and then some high-capacity cables run along the sea floor usually and come on land and connect into the electricity grid via a traditional substation that exists up and down the east coast of Australia already.
So that kind of builds a picture of what it means to a community if an offshore wind farm comes to town. I suppose that's why I'm asking those questions. Danielle, you have your area is very much earmarked for a number of offshore wind farms. There's a number of active licences there in the Gippsland region, but it hasn't been all plain sailing for those projects. Can you tell me what's happening in your area?
Yes, so this is probably one of the biggest things that is happening in Gippsland right now. So we were the first offshore wind area declared for Australia. After that, we had 12 proponents put in for a feasibility license to explore a possible offshore wind farm. But since then, we've had three proponents back out. AGL, just over a fortnight ago, handing their feasibility license back to the state government. Now, different companies have all had their different reasons for doing this. AGL said that they are now going to focus on onshore wind and batteries and other renewable projects. But some proponents have pointed to the delay in getting this industry up off the ground and saying that it's not feasible for them to consider setting up this industry. So that's with those three. But I mean, that said, we also do house the nation's most advanced offshore wind farm, the Star of the South, which has just this week filed its environmental impact statement for approval, which is the main primary approval that you need under the Commonwealth EPBC Act. And the company has also just purchased 120 hectares of farmland where they're going to have underground cables come to shore. So we've sort of got both extremes happening here right now. For those who are still big players in this space, they say they're getting on with their next stages and still feel confident in offshore wind.
Kelly, I know offshore wind has been particularly contentious in your area, but we'll get to that later. Tell me about what's proposed for the Illawarra.
So it did start back in 2019-2020 when Angus Taylor, the Coalition's Minister for Energy, kicked off this discussion and identified the Illawarra as one of those six zones. In August 2023, the federal government under the Energy Department basically began the process identifying this 1,460 square kilometre zone stretching roughly from Stanwell Park, which is south of Sydney, down to Kiama, and it suggested the turbines would be 10 to 30-40 k's off the coast. Now, by June, though, in 2024, they formally declared a zone that was much smaller than they originally proposed, and they said that was based on community feedback. It excluded some environmentally sensitive areas, including that of the biologically important Little Penguin, a key reef as well, and said it observed some of the southern right whale migration reproduction areas. So this was a smaller zone. It reduced the amount of energy that it would produce and down to about 2.9 gigawatts, but they still said it would support a lot of industry and construction and operation. A feasibility license issued in mid-2024, and Blue Float Energy lodged an application for a feasibility license. Now, as the federal election approached, as you mentioned, the political debate intensified. The coalition publicly opposed offshore wind, so really set, two sides of the argument in that debate. There was a really fascinating media conference where the Nationals candidate Katrina Hodgkinson and Whitlam, who later dropped out of the campaign anyway, was at this in Shell Harbour with David Littleproud, the Nationals leader, and they sort of said that the local Shell Harbour mayor was really opposed to the project, and that simply did not represent the mayor's position. He's remained purposefully neutral on this issue, so that was interesting. But anyway, ahead of the election, Blue Float formally requested the government pause assessing its application because they said, or they didn't say, but they inferred, and they didn't talk publicly on the record, but basically they were citing that this was now a partisan issue and they needed bipartisan support and they couldn't continue until they knew if this would be policy following the election. So, look, because of all this, no licences was granted before the election, but as of now, Blue Float has basically folded globally after the election and no other developer has stepped forward, so offshore wind in the Illawarra is effectively paused at the moment.
You're listening to Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan. Despite being blessed with some windy coastline, Australia has been very slow to embrace offshore wind farm technology. Overseas, especially in Europe, massive wind farms power millions of homes. But here in Australia, though, people are very hesitant about the prospect of massive wind turbines out to sea dotting the coastline. To talk about the role of offshore wind in Australia's future energy mix, I'm joined by Ty Christopher, the Director of Energy Futures Network at the University of Wollongong, and my colleagues Kelly Fuller and Danielle Pope. Danielle, I'm interested in the job situation because, as you said, the Star of the Sea is the biggest offshore wind project on the cards at the moment. Are people sceptical about how much local employment this project could bring, or do they see it as an opportunity?
Yeah, so the Star of the South is promising a lot of local jobs, as are the other proponents behind offshore wind. I think it's interesting, though, as an observer, Gippsland really is an area where I think a lot of people feel like, they've been promised the world but delivered an atlas on many cases. We're a microcosm for energy transition here. We've had intergenerational wealth created in areas like the Latrobe Valley, which have housed these coal-fired power stations and provided long-term, stable employment for many, many years, and now that's coming to a close. And we only need to look at the example of the Hazelwood mine, which was closed quite quickly without a transition plan, as a bit of a stark reminder as to what can happen when old industry is wrapped up without a proper plan in place. So transition is a big buzzword here in Gippsland, and there's been a lot of action, not only with Star of the South, but with other proponents in offshore wind and renewables about engaging with the local workforce, the local TAFE and unions that are here to make sure whatever initiatives are being put forward, that they take advantage of that skilled workforce that is already quite energy literate and already based here in Gippsland.
You spoke to Charles Rattray, the CEO of the Massive Star in the South project. Sorry, I got that wrong earlier. Let's hear what he had to say about jobs.
For sort of every gigawatt installed, you're talking a couple of hundred local operational direct jobs that are related specifically to a project. When you expand that out, there are hundreds of job opportunities that are local and sustainable that are about supporting that industry. So you've got catering, you've got tourism, you've got accommodation, you've got a range of other sort of ancillary services that are also sort of local employers and sustainable long-term jobs for the local community.
That's Charles Rattray, the CEO of the Star and the South project. Danielle, is that ringing true for people, though, what he's saying?
I think people want it to be true, and I think some believe it will be true, but I think others will believe it when they see it. And I think that this is the problem when you are trying to establish a new industry that takes so many steps before we can even get off the ground. I mean, Star of the South, having filed its environmental effects statement this week, that's following 7 years and 26 technical studies. So it's such a long process, and some areas of the community can feel disengaged from that because, you know, they're living their day to day and they're seeing job closures. We had in Yarran, the AKD sawmill closed just before Christmas, and that's a major employer for that community. Yet that very same community is one that's set to benefit from being so close to where Star of the South will operate. So I think a lot of people are keen and excited about opportunities that will come. Others are wanting to see something tangible. They're wanting to see contracts. They're wanting to see, you know, structures that they can be a part of.
So, Ty, why isn't there that tangible? We have seen international offshore wind projects pull out this year, pull out of Australia. Why is that happening?
It's a combination of factors. I think the internal politics that that Kelly was alluding to there is certainly part of it. I know the Illawarra region had never seen so many people from the right wing side of politics come and visit us with enthusiasm as when they. I'm trying to find a better phrase than say smelt the blood in the water in terms of offshore wind as a debate they could leverage. But we're also seeing global forces coming into this. These are very large investments that have a very long lead time for construction and an even longer time for the returns to be realised for these companies investing billions and billions of dollars. It's fair to say with the events in the US, with Trump coming to power, with substantial backing from fossil fuel interests, and he's been actively shutting down or withdrawing licenses, even from quite well advanced projects over there in the US, offshore wind in particular. It's put a ripple of uncertainty around investment right the way across the globe. That's what's going to drive in a very substantial way the decision making of these companies. If the community feelings and opposition that we've spoken about here already, yes, that is also part of it. But money talks at the end of the day, and these companies are just big investors. And if they can not encounter so much risk and still make a reasonable return by investing elsewhere, then that's what we're seeing happening. Mm. It's not just happening with offshore wind. It's some other large-scale renewables, particularly in the US, and even things like global shipping and large fleets of aircraft investment are still slowed, if not paused, across the globe at the moment, given the uncertainties that are happening.
It's interesting, though, if you look at onshore wind farms, they also had their opposition in the beginning, but many farmers have now said that it's been a way of making an income off the land. I just want to go back to one of our reporters spoke to Lindsay Marriott, who runs a beef and lamb operation in Tarwin Lower, which is in the Gippsland. Let's have a listen to what he had to say.
We've got five turbines within 300 metres of where we're standing now. And there's a herd of cows here that are very peaceful.
And we're standing here below some of the turbines on your farm. So when did you install them?
They were installed, well, the end of 2012 construction started, and 2013 and into 2014. And it was deemed operational in August 2014.
Was there much opposition once you proceeded to host?
I actually went to the local press that I was having a proposed wind facility, and that was before I had even signed a document and before any other landholders had signed. So we were pretty upfront. That went along okay for a little while, and then the political opposition and the ideology got incredibly intense.
That's farmer Lindsay Marriott, who's had turbines onshore turbines on his property since 2014. Now, Ty, we can hear there that in 2014 he also was having a lot of opposition to those turbines. Has the heat come out of onshore turbines in terms of social licence?
I don't think, given that I don't live in an area where where that's the case, I don't think I can put a blanket yes or no to that as an answer. I think the biggest lesson that we're seeing across the energy transition, and this applies to onshore wind, onshore solar, the transmission lines to connect it, and to offshore wind as well, is we are getting better at engaging with and having a genuine upfront conversation with local communities. And I think the conversations really are steering in the right direction, but there's a lot more that could be done to be talking earnestly about genuine sharing of the benefits that are derived from the clean energy revolution amongst the communities that are, bluntly, most affected by this new infrastructure going in. Because at the end of the day, it's those communities that are bearing the brunt of affectation, and it's all of the rest of us who are reaping the benefits of getting a clean energy future. We are getting better at that consultation and genuinely finding out from communities what they want, and that can only help to, if you like, take the heat or the adversarial nature out of this. But the reality is, with all of this, there's, in most cases, we saw with the offshore wind debate here in the Illawarra, it's too easy sometimes, and I mean no offence given everyone here, but it's too easy for the media to characterise things in the binary of for or against or black or white. When you start to look at the reality of it, of the public discourse and formal submissions that were made here in the Illawarra, the common ground between them all was genuine passion, care and concern for the environment. It was just in some cases that manifested with people being concerned for the environment globally and the impacts on our oceans for global warming and the need to decarbonise. And for others, it was a focus on their local environment and the local land or sea-based environment where they live. But the common ground was a genuine passion and care for our planet. That's a better place to start a conversation than are you for or are you against anything.
I'm going to do exactly what you don't want me to do here now, Ty, because we are looking at the for and against, because Kelly, very much in your area, there's been heated stand-up debates, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's been really extraordinary. There were protests and paddle outs in October 2023. We saw several MPs, including former One Nation MP Tanya Mahalki and Shooters MP Mark Banasiak, attend them in Wollongong, where Mark Banasiak called the project BS. He used the full swear word, though, and he said overseas workers would come and take local jobs. It escalated during the federal election campaign in February, where anti-offshore wind farm campaigner Alex O'Brien heckled Prime Minister Anthony Albanese when he visited the seat of Whitlam. And recently, in October, a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry into renewable energy zones, initiated by Mark Banasiak, the MP who stood at the protest opposing it, held a hearing in Wollongong. Alex O'Brien gave evidence, and so did local supporters like Yale Stone, and here's a little bit of what they had to say.
What we simply want is a pause in this project. We want a new consultation process with the community. We do not want developer PR or government mistruths. We want independent full system cost analysis and environmental modelling to happen before anything proceeds. And we want a pathway to protecting Australian industry, jobs and sovereignty. We want to contribute to the energy solution. We have made this clear to Minister Sharp as well, that we would have liked to be involved in the discussion about the urban renewable energy zone. But we refuse to be an experiment, and we refuse to be lied to as a community.
Hard to imagine, but it got really nasty in a very damaging way, such that, you know, you kind of... We're a small community. We're kind of... The Illawarra is long and thin, so you sort of... You're up against people all the time. And there were physically threatening moments even, and times when I felt not safe. I got calls that were accusing me of all kinds of things that were simply not true from people who knew my home address. I've got two young children. I have a public face as well. It started to feel very unhealthy and really not what I'd signed up for when I tried to make a really cohesive, inclusive community organisation.
Callie, they're quite extraordinary words there from Yaldstone.
Yeah, she was honestly, and some other supporters of the program were really expressive of the fear they felt. And I know the local federal MP has received also very threatening responses on social media too that have caused her alarm.
A big part of the opposition to offshore wind farms is the visual impact on the coastline, and this is the kind of thing that's said about that.
I mean, when we go to the beach, we want to see nothing but blue sky and ocean out there. We don't want to come and see wind turbines littered across the landscape.
We want to see nothing but blue sky and ocean, and I think there'll be people listening going, fair enough, that's all I want to see when I go to the beach. Is that some of the objection in your patch, Danielle?
Look, we haven't had that strong a feedback, not certainly to the effect of listening to those sound bites from the Illawarra. We haven't had such impassioned views that way. I think it's a bit more nuanced than that here in Gippsland because we have so many players proposing so many different things. So I think it really depends on which farm. So Gippslanders here, I mean, they have really high energy literacy. They care very deeply about where they live too. I think the greatest feedback we get around visual amenity is for the Blue Mackerel Farm. So that's a proposed farm off the coast of the 90 Mile Beach, and the local community there are worried about visual amenity. It's looking to be maybe 10 kilometres offshore, but then there's also concerns about impact to wildlife as well. So I know the company Blue Mackerel, who also just received major project status from the federal government for their farm, have been working with the community on this issue and have recently just created visuals or a mock-up so that you can log on and see what the farm would look like from 17 different viewpoints. But I think more broadly, there's wider concerns around job creation, where are people going to live, do we have appropriate infrastructure and housing to support these developments that are being proposed.
Finally, I spoke earlier about what it's like walking on the beach in England, and you can see the turbines, particularly at night, they kind of blink back at you. There's these like lights out into the ocean. If these projects get up, Ty, what would people see here in Australia if they're walking along the beach?
Well, it depends on which location we're talking about. I'll talk specifically about the Illawarra. I certainly appreciate the comments that were made there about people wanting to see the clean ocean and the blue skies. So clearly those same people must be very displeased about the fact that at any given day you can see a couple of dozen coal ships and ships with cars and iron ore and all sorts of things on them at quite close proximity to the shoreline here in the Illawarra. The proposal for the Illawarra put the turbines 20 kilometres out to sea. And what that means is on any sort of haze or any sort of hazy day, for a person of average height standing on the beach, it's actually going to be very difficult to see them at all. If you're in an elevated position, a waterfront home on an elevated cliff, you will have probably a better view of them. I'm trying not to sound too cheekily cynical there, but I don't think I succeeded. I don't think it's fair to dismiss people's concerns about the visual impact of them. But what I would also say is much of the same community, in fact, many of the same community members in the Illawarra, said all of these same things: industrialising our coastline, it'll be an eyesore, visual amenity, etc., about the Seacliff Bridge prior to its construction in the northern suburbs of the Illawarra. Now, it's just celebrated to great fanfare, its iconic status as a tourist attraction here in the Illawarra. 20 years the Seacliff Bridge has been in place. And I don't think there's been a car ad shot in Australia in the last 20 years that didn't have it driving along the Seacliff Bridge here in the Illawarra. So I do think there's an element here of people do warm over time to things, but don't like the abruptness of change when confronted with it. And that's a natural human reaction.
Well, as we said, Australia's wind farm industry is very much, well, its offshore wind farm industry is very much at its infancy. And first projects are expected for 2030, but we shall see. Ty Christopher, the Director of Energy Futures Network at the University of Wollongong, and my colleagues Kelly Fuller in the Illawarra and Danielle Pope in Gippsland, thanks very much for chatting to Australia Wide today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Australia Wide for today. I'm Sinead Mangan. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen.